Good morning.
Good morning, Robin.
Oh my goodness, happy Father's Day. I was expecting kind of a small group due to the holiday. And hello, everybody online. Let's see. I've been asked to introduce myself, and I thought, well, I guess there are people here. I know so many of you, and I don't know some of you. So I'm Anne, and I received transmission here last fall, and this is still my place of practice, and but I'm a little bit different from the rest of the priests you see wandering around here. I'm no longer an official member of the group of priests, sort of with them and not with them. I am more in the tradition of ordination, where the priests go off and teach independently. So that's what I'm doing, and so I'm really happy to be here to have a chance to talk with you. And I want to thank Ben and Ted for inviting me. And any of you who know me are saying right now, she's lying. Because of my aversion to having to give a Dharma talk. But really, it does, I'm just so happy to see you and to be here. This wonderful place, you know, the lake, we walk Kinhin in the morning with the trees in our particular sacred tree, the three-limbed tree from, or the three-trunked tree, that it, from our Native American predecessors who moved to Eden Prairie, I'm told, because the farming was better there. But we still have the nature surrounding us here. We're so fortunate to have. So, get to the talk. My topic today is Zen humor in the face of suffering or moments of disruption. And I want you to know that I did not choose this topic. I do not like, or I don't like Zen humor. It always seemed really not funny. Kind of you know, frat boy stuff. Animal House. and it shows up in the literature. It's mostly in the koans, where one monk is yanking another by the nose, or a teacher is slapping a student, or another student is walking out of the room with his shoes on his head. It seemed to me like jokes where you kind of had to be there. But you know, resistance that I have usually catches up with me and makes me take another look. And that's what happened. That's what happened this spring when the 20th anniversary of my mother's death coincided with my friend Missy's cancer treatments, and I was, you know, one of the people taking to her treatments. So my mother's death and Missy's cancer treatments, although 20 years apart. Hilarious, right? But it was the events in this coinciding that made me think, something's going on here. I better take another look at Zen humor. I had no idea what I'd find. So my main source for this, not the only, but my main source is Andrew K. Whitehead. He's a comparative philosopher in East-West philosophy. And he's done quite a study of this, and he wrote a paper that I came across that is titled, She Who Laughs Loudest. We know that Zen is not the only religion where humor pops up. Jewish comics have made an industry out of humor. Jokes about Catholics abound. What's different about Zen humor, it seems to me, is that it's actually part of the literature. It's the teaching, a lot of the teaching comes out of it. And I realized that I didn't like Zen humor because I didn't understand the philosophy behind it. So this, you know, this is by no means going to be comprehensive. I've sort of just taken what seemed meaningful to me, and that's what I'm talking about. So, you know, first I'm going to give just a little background, and I will tell you that Andrew Whitehead made the point that philosophical discussion about Zen humor is decidedly unfunny. So, lower your expectations. let's see, where was I? Okay, it's important to know that Zen is an embodied practice. We bow, we sit, we walk, we eat, we clean. It's embodied. And so it just makes sense that Zen humor is an embodied humor. Thus the yanking of the nose and the slapping and the, all that carrying on. But most importantly, you'll notice in the koans that it is always around relationships. It's in the interactions of one person to another. And so now just a brief look at how Zen humor came to be. And Whitehead says that it came out of a collision between Indian spirituality and the earthiness of the Chinese. As Buddhism traveled from India to China, the Indian spiritualism has these strict restrictions around the body in humor. And that was abandoned when Buddhism got to China, so that the Chinese could put forth more their view of well, their philosophy, I guess. And their worldview was earthier, based in nature, grounded in the body. And the so the icon that rose out of this Chinese belief is a gift to me, this little guy. He is the happy Buddha, you know, his fat little belly and his gesture. So he represents this embodied nature of Zen, and then this embodied nature accelerated when Zen came to Japan, when the Taoist influence was really big. So the main thing about the embodied nature of this is that it allows the teachings to go beyond the thinking mind, reaches beyond that. And it has this embodied nature of the teaching really has a power to reach beyond the thinking mind. So when we look at the features of the koans, the action by the teacher that enlightens the student has these features. It's lightning quick. It is not premeditated and spontaneous. It doesn't issue from the thinking mind. And it's funny. It has this funny strike because it upsets conventional expectations. It exploits the tension around sort of being proper. And it also shows up in, you know, like the Three Stooges, in the Marx Brothers, this upset of what we think is proper and conventional, plays with that. And the purpose of all that is that we think in this samsaric world, we think that we know how everything should be, and we think we know what's real. And these koans tell us, you know, don't be so sure. Don't be so sure. Or as Marlowe says in The Wire, you think it's one way, and it's the other way. So philosophically, the karmic spirit of Zen is tied to emptiness. And it's grounded in the two truths theory of Zen. Things are true and they're not true. There's the conventional truth and there's the ultimate truth. And both truths are seemingly mutually exclusive when you see it in example. If this is true, how can this be true? But that's how we get to, in Zen, middle way. Because two truths that seem mutually exclusive express one reality. And sort of this knowing of the two truths and seeing the one reality is why we see that sort of bemused look on the Buddhas, the statues of the Buddhas that we see. It's this sort of bemused look. And we think it's because they're so blissed out and still, but really they just see the joke of the whole thing. So that's enough of the heavy part, you know, the dry, the unfunny. Now I get to the life and death of it. But I have two overlapping stories to tell now. Missy and my mother. So Missy is a friend who is half my age. She's an engineer at a medical device company. She is curious, she is bright-eyed, energetic, and she's in a year of these life and death treatments for cancer. And she has a whole posse of people volunteering to take her to these treatments, and we each get these assigned dates. And my second time to go with her was the time that coincided with the day before my mother's birthday, which 20 years ago, she died 5 days after her 89th birthday. And I had spent a week with her during that time at the same hospital where Missy was going for her treatments. And always on the anniversary of my mother's death, I have this sense of, you know, the air is the same, the light is the same. There's just this kind of quality about that time of year. But there was something about the 20th year, you know, that round number that seemed somehow more important. And I had been writing about my time with her at the hospital and her death we were leading up to the actual anniversary. I'd been writing about her every morning because we had had a difficult relationship. And so when she died, it wasn't just the loss of a parent. It was really a loss of what had never been. And my feelings of grief around that and my feelings of guilt, really. So when I came to my Zen practice, you know, for a long time, that's what came up on the cushion. And I sometimes wondered if it would ever end. There was just so much to process. You know, and you don't set out to do that on the cushion. You don't. It's just whatever comes up. So my time 20 years ago with my mother in the hospital was really an intense time. And if you've ever been through anything like that, you know how stressful it is. You're just in this world, this altered universe. It's just really stressful. And my mother had been just really, really sick, temperature spiking, you know, to 105, in and out of lucidity, and no one would say if she was dying or if she was just sick. So this was all there. And as Missy and I drove up to the hospital, I just had this sense of deja vu. And it's like I just couldn't shake it. It's just deja vu. But as we entered the hospital, I completely forgot about it because there was this whirlwind of activity heading into Missy's treatment. And things were happening pretty fast. A volunteer met us to take Missy to her labs, and then she showed us to the treatment room, and right away we noticed that, well, this treatment room is different from the last time. Last time, the windows looked out onto this beautiful marshy land, and now there was this fake screen on the wall with this fake window that was a fake view of pine trees and mountains and a stream, so that was weird. And then there was, you know, we're offered a snack. We're here for this life and death treatment, and we're offered a snack. And there's a big deal around Missy's favorite cookies, these almond cookies. And so they brought us these almond cookies and the juice box. And we were told there would be no music therapist today, but there might be a therapy dog, a Newfoundland. Newfoundlander, those huge dogs, you know, those big furry things. And there was this team of people coming and going. There was the treatment nurse. There's this little plastic bag of the medicine, $30,000 each treatment. So there was also another nurse that came in to check the work of the first nurse, so that there weren't any $30,000 mistakes. And then the oncologist comes in and talks to Missy about the labs and talks to her about any side effects. And all this is going on, and I'm right there, you know, I'm not on my cell phone or anything, not checking messages. I'm really present, but I have this sense at one point, watching all this, that I kind of moved to a shelf high in the room, and I'm just looking down, watching all this. And then Missy remembered that her primary care doctor wanted her to schedule a colonoscopy because of family history, and she had trouble getting that scheduled. And so she asked, could I get help with that here? And the doctor said, sure, we'll send in the scheduler. And so Missy asked, well, what's the scheduler's name? And the doctor couldn't remember. She said, oh, it's some adjective. And that caught my attention. Would that be Snoopy? Grumpy? Happy? I couldn't wait. So Missy, ever the people person, asked everyone who came into the room, what is the schedule? Do you know the scheduler's name? Do you? And finally somebody said, oh yeah, it's eternity. And I, on my shelf, you know, burst out laughing. No, for one thing, eternity is not an adjective. And this struck me. But also, what are the chances, you know, in this situation that we're going to get a scheduler named eternity? But nobody else was laughing. So I quickly stifled myself. And meanwhile, you know, the activity goes on. There's the $30,000 medicine coursing through Missy's veins at this point, and Missy and the oncologist are now exchanging stories about their activities in South America, where the Engineers Without Borders and the Doctors Without Borders, and you know, they both are involved in this volunteer work, and so chatting, and at one point they're speaking in Spanish. And then a hand grabs the door and opens it, you know, pink flamingo fingernails, and this head full of blonde hair pops in, and Missy turns and says, eternity? Well, I completely cracked up. But knowing that was not proper, that was not the conventional behavior among these devoted professionals in this life and death situation. So I'm wearing a mask, and I am trying not to laugh, and my eyes are burning with tears, and they're streaming down my face, and the mask is absorbing the tears. And I'm thinking, what is going on with me? You know, Missy is recovering. She's recovering. But she's also going to die. You know, just like we're all going to die. And we're all in this room acting like everything's as normal as can be. We have the fake window and the fake scenery and the special almond cookies and me with my juice box and hoping for the dog the size of the bear, waiting for a scheduler named eternity. So the absurdity of it all somehow got in through some crack in me. So back to Andrew Whitehead, he points out that there's a pattern to our samsaric world. And these patterns form certain expectations in us. And things are running along according to this expected pattern. When someone walks in and upsets the apple cart. And the unexpected occurs. And this is the point in the Zen koans when the teacher slaps the student, or and the student wakes up, you know, enlightenment. Well, I did not get enlightened, but I did burst into laughter in that treatment room. But Eternity does schedule the colonoscopy. It takes 40 minutes, you know, with music by Lionel Richie playing on her computer. But she does get it scheduled, and we're leaving the hospital. And again, I got this sense of deja vu, just deja vu. The hospital doesn't look, you know, there's a parking lot where, you know, it doesn't look the same. In 20 years, it's going to change. But I have this sense of familiarity. And it wasn't until the next day when I was doing that writing I had been doing around my mother that I remembered a particular incident with my mother, and there were many incidents during that week, many. Because she was in and out of lucidity, and I never knew how she was going to show up. But this was toward the end of the week, and they brought a priest in to give her last rites, the sacrament of the sick, and my mother was asleep during that, and she was devoted Catholic, and I thought that she would appreciate knowing that the priest had been there and given her last rites. So I told her that. When she woke up, she seemed really lucid this time. She seemed unusually calm. And so I told her, the priest was here to give you last rites. And there was this pause. And she said, I think it's funny. And I thought, funny. This has been the most stressful week of my life. And I said, what's funny? And she said, all of it. And at the time, you know, I didn't, you know, we didn't talk further about it. We didn't have a conversation about it. And I didn't know. What does that mean? What did that mean to her? What did that mean to her? And then the next day she stopped eating. And 5 days later, you know, she had been only the sound of these little baby breaths for 5 days. And then on the fifth day, between 9 and noon, she took these three enormous exhales. And then she was gone. So I waited with her, and then the undertakers came and took her away. And leaving that day at the elevator was a man who was familiar to me. He had been with his wife all these 11 years that we were in the nursing home. He was across the hall. every single day, spending every single day with his wife, who was there in body, but not with her mind. But he was there with her, you know, such devotion. And we had never exchanged a word, never once. But he's there at the elevator. And he says to me, "I'm sorry for the loss of your mother." And he said, "She really suffered." And I, you know, that just pierced me. I thought, one thing, how did you know? And I also thought, if you only knew the half of it, if you only knew. You know, and in Buddhism, it's our first noble truth. I mean, we all suffer. We all suffer. You know, it's fundamental to being a conscious human being. But we also know that some people suffer more than others. And, you know, my mother, I think, was in the category of receiving more than her share of suffering. And, you know, that was part of my grief, that in looking back, I felt that so much of the time I contributed to rather than eased her suffering. And so much guilt around that I had. I also knew from childhood that my mother had a practice of, she said the rosary every day. And when I was a little older, she would take a 3-mile walk every night in rain and shine and sub-zero temperatures, and she would have a rosary in her pocket. She would always do this at night. And I can see now that that was her zazen, her practice of facing suffering and abiding with it in silence and having nowhere else to go. And just, and that was her training in compassion, just like we do on the cushion, just sitting with whatever is, being with it, training in compassion. So later in life, in the nursing home, she was blind and deaf and in a wheelchair after a stroke. She told me that, she was cognitively sure, and she told me that she was now saying 3 rosaries a day, 1 for each of her children. And that's a lot of sitting in a day. A lot of facing life as it is, with nowhere to go. And I believe that through that practice, there was a gradual surrender. And, you know, what we know about mind and body dropping away, realizing the interconnectedness of all things. And in the end, I think she saw the absurdity of it all, the lengths we go to. Crazy lengths we go to avoid suffering, to to make life be the way we think it's supposed to be. And I think this struck her as funny. And simultaneously with that insight, she felt a flood of compassion for how hard we all try against all our layers of conditioning that we're stuck with. And I think that this compassion in the flash of humor, compassion in the flash of humor, is out of the same stuff that Doug was talking about in the 89th koan on the Blue Cliff Records. And you know what, it was just this morning that I thought, 89th koan, my mother was 89 when she died. So anyway, in the 89th koan about Dawu is explaining, you know, why is it that Avalokiteshvara has all these arms and eyes, and he says that it's the compassion is like reaching for the pillow in the night. It's non-thinking, it's spontaneous. So I think that in those bursts of action by the teachers and the koans, in a burst of laughter, that compassion is there. It's that non-thinking urge. And then there's just one more thing. I'm almost finished. The night after my mother died, I had a dream, just this brief, quick dream. And I was, so in this dream, I'm sitting alone in the church where I grew up. And my mother enters from the side. She crosses the front of the altar. She's coming from nowhere. She's headed nowhere. And as she's passing, she looks at me, gives me a thumbs up. Now, I did not take it as, you know, you're okay, Anne. No worries, you're okay. Forget the guilt. No, I didn't take it like that. I thought it was something larger than that. She was dressed in her raincoat and these, you know, she was like she looked in the 60s. She had a raincoat and these black rimmed glasses. And but in preparing for this talk, you know, that gesture is this. It's okay. So, what do I make of all this? What was my mother telling me? Well, this is Norman Fisher, who can sort of tell it like it is, like nobody else, wrote this a few years ago. We are all in a mess. we're all miserable and upset, and everything is terrible. And there's all this suffering, and we're trying to end suffering. Now, he wrote this several years ago, before we started to watch the climate melt and burn up before us, and before Trump entered the scene. All due respect to any Trump supporters here. And then the other day I saw an image of Trump last week, and he's giving, I thought, you know, the end is really near. Talk about the two truths. Fisher goes on to say that even if you're not feeling so miserable right now, even if things are going pretty well, we know what's around the corner. And we know where we're all headed. And yet the teachings say that in the end, everything is fine. And, you know, we know that. We know that. Every day when we sit on the cushion, no matter how frantic the mind is or what the word, I mean, we know that deep down, maybe just for a second. But we know it, and we've always known that, but we've forgotten, somehow we've forgotten, and we continue to forget. I used to hate it when teachers talk this way. What are you talking about? I never feel any of that. Knowing this or knowing that, or transformation or joy, or but you just sort of keep sitting. So I think my mother's gesture was the reminder, a seeing that everything is really okay. There are two truths. There's the samsaric world, and there's the ultimate world. Everything is really okay. And we just need to occasionally remember that. So, you know, maybe the next time you find yourself in just one of those lightning flash bursts of laughter, and I don't mean the sort of nervous giggle or the chortling, I mean that burst of laughter that comes out of nowhere. We can remember that we're connected. We're all connected. We're interconnected through compassion. That death does not destroy life. And we're free. So, Missy is still recovering. I have more appreciation for Zen humor than I did. And I have an ever-changing, ever-growing relationship with my mother, Roshi Mary. And she is here in this photo with a bemused look on her face. So I invite you to take a look if you want. And I hope it's not, yikes. Okay. I'm just so happy you were with me today. Thank you so much. And there's precious time, little time, precious little time, if you want to have your say. Or not. someone online, Tim Kennedy.
All right, thanks so much, Anne, for your talk. It reminded me of a story, which, let me try to say this. There was a guy who thought he was dead, and his family was very concerned about this. So they sent him to a psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist had him stand before a mirror and tell himself repeatedly, over and over, "Dead men don't bleed. Dead men don't bleed. Dead men don't bleed." And after this went on for some time, the doctor came up to him, poked his finger with a needle, which started to bleed. And the doctor said at that point, "What does that mean?" And the gentleman answered, "Dead men do bleed."
Thank you,
Tim. So it's both and, right? And the compassion and the laughter is, thanks very much for that. Yeah.
Thanks, Tim.
Yeah. I just wanted to thank you for coming and talking to them. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you.
All right.